If you started your day with a few down dogs or chaturangas and rewarded yourself with shavasana and maybe a trip to Lululemon, you can thank a man named Pierre Bernard. He's the reason why 15 million Americans practice yoga on a regular basis. Bernard was born Perry Baker in a small town in Iowa in 1875. He went on to master Hindu philosophy and yoga without ever leaving the United States. And by the time he died in 1955, he'd set the foundation for what is today a $7 billion industry. Yet during his lifetime, and this is unbelievable,
yoga was labeled a criminal fraud and an abomination against the purity of American women. It was associated with sexual promiscuity and kicked to the fringes of society.
That's Robert Love, reading from his new biography of Pierre Bernard. It's called The Great The Improbable Birth of Yoga in America. And Robert Love is in our New York bureau. Welcome.
Thank you, Guy. I'm happy to be here.
How was this kid from small-town Iowa even exposed to the ideas that would eventually launch the yoga craze in America?
Well, it was a million-to-one shot, but he actually met a tantric yogi in Lincoln, Nebraska in 1889. Perry Baker was 13 years old and had been sent there by his family to learn the building trades. However, he was interested in nothing but the occult arts and occult literature and ended up meeting a fellow named Silvaeus Hammadi, who was a Syrian-Indian practitioner and teacher of Hatha Yoga and Tantric Yoga.
So this kid, Perry Baker, sort of taken under the wing, under his tutelage of this Indian emigre, how does that unfold? I mean, does he just start to study under him day after day, week after week, year after year?
He becomes the chela in the guru-chela relationship, which is the guru-student relationship, and basically stays with Hammadi for the next 18 years. Perry Baker's parents allowed this, and his mother was even kind enough to give him a little stipend to sort of get along while he was in Hammadi's care.
And they didn't think it was unusual? I mean, we are still talking about Lincoln, Nebraska in the late 19th century.
It is completely unusual and wildly, non-conforming to allow your son to be taken away by a Syrian Indian tutor of yoga in Lincoln, Nebraska in 1889. It goes against most of what America believed at the time.
Now, eventually, Baker and Hammadi would go to San Francisco. Perry Baker would at that point become Pierre Bernard, the person whose name we now associate with yoga. At the beginning, you describe what he was doing as something akin to a sideshow circus act. I mean, he would sort of perform publicly by pushing pins through his lips and claiming he felt no pain. What was he doing?
He did it as an example of how you could use self-hypnosis to induce anesthesia in a deep enough trance and be operated on. He was selling his course on the occult and hypnotic arts to doctors, and it cost a great deal of money to learn these things from him.
Now, he was in San Francisco, where Pierre Bernard started something called the Tantric Order in America. Describe what it was.
The Tantric Order was a secret society that Bernard concocted. It was a kind of a blueprint for living. He wanted to establish lodges throughout the United States and around the world, indeed, in which yoga would be taught along with Hindu philosophy.
And the order sort of gained a reputation for being a den of immorality, that opium was used there, that you had to have sexual intercourse with another member in front of the group to get in. Was there any truth to any of that?
There's no record of truth to the opium charges, and it's not true that you had to have sacramental intercourse to get into the club. However, there is a record that the sum of this sex as a part of the tantric ritual did occur in San Francisco.
In 1909, Bernard goes to New York to set up a yoga school there. He very quickly becomes embroiled in scandal that would sort of consume, I guess, about a year of his life. What happened?
He was arrested, jailed in the Tombs for inveigling a young woman to have sexual intercourse with him. And for a week in New York, he made the headlines. It was there that he was rechristened the omnipotent loving guru of the tantrics by the headline writers in the yellow press of the time.
I'm speaking with Robert Love, author of a new biography of Pierre Bernard. It's called The Great The Improbable Birth of Yoga in America. Now, after the trial, he relocates to upstate New York, where he spends the rest of his life teaching yoga on this grand estate. And all of this because he finds a patron in the Vanderbilt family. Can you explain how that came about?
In 1918, he runs into Anne Vanderbilt, and she becomes very interested in yoga. And such wonderful things happened to the Vanderbilt family through their relationship with Bernard that she ended up bankrolling part of his move to Nyack, New York, where he began to buy land and set up what is basically the first established American ashram. It was a wild, weird, and wonderful thing that he called the Clarkstown Country Club, calling it by this opaque name because yoga still had such a louche reputation.
Your description of the Clarkstown Country Club certainly does not sound like an ashram. It sounds more like something that resembled a circus with elephants and baseball games played in drag and so on. Describe what it was like.
Well, the cream of the crop of American society was interested in Bernard's teachings. There were heiresses from wealthy families, a Great War spy named Sir Paul Dukes. There were attorneys, and Bernard put on professional-grade circuses and vaudeville entertainments that lasted from tea in the afternoon till dawn. And he did all of this out of a belief that this was part of becoming a well-rounded person. He was so far ahead of his time that it's no wonder he was lost to history. People didn't know what to do with him. We want our gurus and our holy men to be soft-spoken ascetics. And here is a true American rough-and-tumble original who happened to be a mystic as well.
Given that yoga is now a multi-billion dollar industry, some call it the yoga industrial complex, do you think Pierre Bernard would be proud of what it has become?
You know, I think he would be divided about it because he believed in the guru-student relationship, which means that you really can't divide yourself 1,000 times to turn it into a huge thing. So I think in some ways he would be offended by it, and in other ways he would have to take some credit for it because here he was in San Francisco in 1900 setting down the rules for how yoga would be taught, 4-inch thick hair mattresses in a room of equable temperatures. He was the one who Americanized what he had learned from Hammadi and then taught it to others who taught it to others who taught it to others.
And without him, we wouldn't be doing it today, probably.
Well, I think he's a missing link in the great story of how yoga moved from east to west. I think he's a real pioneer in bringing yoga to America.
That's Robert Love. His new book is called The Great The Improbable Birth of Yoga in the United States. Robert Love, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
In state after state, lawmakers are targeting teacher pay, tenure, seniority, and questioning how teachers are evaluated. Many teachers and their unions say they're getting the blame for just about everything that can go wrong in schools. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Central Falls High, a struggling school in Rhode Island, recently fired all its teachers in large part because only 7% of its 11th graders passed the state's math test. But here's the question. Are the teachers at fault?
No, they probably deserve a portion of the blame, but now we're just being stepped on.
That's George McLaughlin, one of the 89 faculty members who was fired. He says teachers want students to succeed, but more and more people are convinced.
The problem with education is teachers.
Even the president of the United States seems to be saying it, says McLaughlin. Mr. Obama made headlines when he injected himself into the labor dispute at Central Falls High and condoned the firings after teachers refused to work more hours without pay to raise students' abysmal test scores.
If a school continues to fail its students year after year after year, but doesn't show any sign of improvement, then there's got to be a sense of accountability.
Mr. Obama, of course, is not the first politician to criticize teachers' unions for opposing tough measures ostensibly to improve schools. But firing teachers en masse?
That's not part of the administration policy, and I wish they would speak out and say that.
Dennis Van Rokel is president of the National Education Association, the nation's largest teachers' union. He says he's astonished by the hostility towards teachers and the administration's reluctance to denounce it.
I would hate to see this administration labeled as anti-teacher.
Van Rokel says teachers are taking the brunt of the most aggressive efforts to turn around failing schools, not just shutting them down or firing principals and teachers, but attacking hard-earned benefits like tenure and seniority. Van Rokel says the Obama administration's race to the top fund is even offering states and local school districts billions of dollars to tie teacher evaluations to students' test scores. An example of how this unprecedented level of scrutiny from Washington is affecting teachers, says Van Rokel, is Guilford County, North Carolina. The school board there is asking the U.S. Education Department for $2 million to help pay for a complete overhaul of 10 schools. And yes, teachers in at least one school will be dismissed, says Mo Green, the county school superintendent.
Dismissal is maybe too strong a word. It certainly would require that the faculty would have to no longer be at the school, because if you close the school, then there would not be any faculty at that school.
By the way, what would you say to anyone who would say what they're doing down in Guilford County is nothing more than teacher bashing?
This is not teacher bashing at all. This is what amounts to a fresh start.
Teachers in Guilford County say they're demoralized for good reason, says Van Rokel.
You ignore your own policies of due process. You ignore the rights of employees. I mean, how do you look in the face of a PE teacher, a history teacher, or a cafeteria worker and say, the reason you don't have a job is because our fourth graders, compared to last year's fourth graders, didn't do well on a math and reading test?
So if schools are failing and kids aren't learning, the question remains, do teachers and their unions deserve more of the blame than, let's say, shrinking education budgets, poverty, or bad parenting? Maybe not, says Rick Hess of the American Enterprise Institute, but teachers are easy targets.
If the unions in the past 25 years had been more aggressive partners in trying to police their own ranks and trying to work with reform-minded superintendents, we would be at a very different conversation today.
What's clear, says Hess, is that Mr. Obama and the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, are on a collision course with teachers and their unions.
I think they understand to build a bipartisan coalition to drive school reform, they can't be seen as letting teachers off the hook.
The risks for the Obama administration are that teachers and their unions will increasingly oppose and block the president's school reform proposals at every turn, and that more teachers, including the best ones, will leave the profession if they think they're not being treated as educators, but as punching bags. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
In Brussels, finance ministers from across Europe are meeting today. Their goal is to find a way to keep Greece's worsening debt crisis from wreaking havoc in all the countries that use the euro as currency. Investors in the United States and Asia are paying close attention. Last week's brief stock market collapse showed that the euro crisis is threatening the global economy. NPR's Tom Gelton is following the developments from Madrid. He joins us now. And Tom, I mean, so far, the European governments haven't had a lot of success in managing the Greek debt crisis. Have they come up with any new ideas?
Well, they do have another idea, Leanne. It's another emergency fund. They're calling it a stabilization fund, a bunch of loans to Greece from the European Union's own accounts, in addition to the $145 billion that's already been promised by the EU and the IMF. They are due to announce this fund this afternoon. The idea is to get the news out there before the Asian markets open, which will be this evening, U.S. time. They want to send the markets a message that they are determined to act.
You know, this is all reminiscent of what happened in the fall of 2008, financial panic and markets and free fall. Have the governments learned any lessons from that experience so that crisis is not repeated?
The big lesson is that a crisis like this can get real serious real fast, Leanne, so you'd better be careful. But as far as the specifics, it's actually a little hard because there's not total agreement on what the lessons of 2008 really were. Clearly, the big event at that time was the decision to let Lehman Brothers go bankrupt. That's what precipitated the panic and the financial crisis. And I think there is a broad view, not a unanimous view, but a broad view that it was a mistake to let Lehman Brothers go. So the lesson there is that Greece can't be handled the way Lehman Brothers was handled. It has to be solved here and now. But some say the economy would have tanked even if Lehman Brothers had been saved. And in the same way, it's not clear that Greece's problems actually can be contained, because it's not just Greece. European banks are exposed to Greek debt. If they are hurt, it could freeze lending throughout Europe, could trigger another European recession. This means Greece's problems have to be addressed in a way that limits the damage elsewhere, and it won't be easy.
We just heard about the uncertainty of Britain's next government. There are also state elections this weekend in Germany. What effect will these have?
It's a really critical issue, Leanne, because the single biggest question right now is whether there is political will in these European capitals to do what needs to be done. Investors wonder about that. They wonder whether governments will be able to do what they have to do. And when you have weak governments, it's only going to add to that uncertainty. It's true in Britain, and it's even more true in Germany. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, is a key player in this drama. If these state elections this weekend go against her, she'll be politically weakened. It will raise questions about whether she can push through the things that Germany needs to do. So politics does have a lot to do with it.
As I mentioned, you're in Madrid, and Spain is another country with a big debt problem. So if Greece's problems are going to spread, Spain might be next. So what's the mood there?
I have to say, Leanne, that it's not as urgent as you would think. It's actually somewhat polarized. I think on the one hand, the government has been very upbeat, reassuring the people that everything is going to be okay, and the people seem to be buying it. There's not a lot of nervousness. On the other hand, there is a vocal opposition that's led by economists and the business community warning that this is a lot more serious than the government says it is and pressing the government land to take tougher actions than they've been willing to take so far.
NPR's Tom Gelton in Madrid, Spain. Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you, Leanne.
Grandma is a great heave of a woman in a billowing black dress. That's the first line of a story we received from listener Mike Van Mantgam of Eugene, Oregon. Mike's story is among the 3,800 short stories you sent in during this round of our 3-Minute Fiction Contest. It's called Pearl Cadillac, and it opens with a scene shortly after the death of the narrator's grandfather.
It's like Norman when he had to go to that hospital down in Iowa City after his accident, Aunt Laura says, soft and kind like she is. It was so sudden. The wrinkles on Grandma's face tighten. She stows her knitting and hauls herself up. It wasn't the same. We all know it. Grandma trudges across the back lawn, the knitting needles glint in her grasp. Uncle Norm had been high up in the big oak, trimming out branches near the power line, when he touched a wire. The jolt seized his heart, blew off a boot, and knocked him to the ground. The impact restarted his heart and broke his leg. He lost 3 toes. The doctors grafted on new fingertips using skin from his stomach. Each little button sprouted a patch of coarse hair. He likes to make dirty jokes about it when he shakes hands with strangers.
That's a passage from Pearl Cadillac by Mike Van Mantgam of Eugene, Oregon. It was read by our own Linda Wertheimer. Mike's story was picked as one of our favorites so far. To read the whole thing, check out our website, npr.org/3-Minute Fiction, and that's 3-Minute Fiction all spelled out, no spaces. And stay tuned, because our judge this round, the novelist Ann Patchett, is very close to announcing the winner.